Good evening, everybody. This is Tanner from TMNBaseballFan.com. I am reporting, as per usual, in my neighborhood, walking around. I didn't really have anything that was like kind of burning on my mind to talk about tonight. So, I really just kind of first started thinking about this a few seconds before I pressed record. The subject is, what makes a baseball card valuable? A lot of people are going to hopefully learn a lot from this. Now, I'd imagine that a lot of you listening are going to already know this stuff, but hopefully you'll pick up a few tidbits here and there, and at the very least, it'll get your brain to start churning a little bit and think a little more about this. So a lot of people have the misconception that what makes a baseball card valuable is who's on it. And that is not necessarily true all the time. All the time, I get people asking me if I'm interested in purchasing their collection. You know, I always say, yeah, I'd love to see what you have. What do you have? And they always come back and say, oh, I've got all the stars. Nolan Ryan, Ken Griffey Jr., Mickey Mantle, Barry Bonds, Cal Ripken Jr., and the list goes on. Tony Gwynn, Don Mattingly, Kirby Puckett, Roger Clemens. And you may know this, but I'm going to say it anyways. It obviously doesn't matter. There's a massive difference between a PSA 10 1984 Fleer FD Roger Clemens and a 1989 score Raw Roger Clemens. So, same thing with the Griffey. Yeah, a rare 90s Griffey that's worth thousands of dollars, or it could be a 91 Donruss All-Star Griffey that's, you know, not even worth a dime. So it really all depends not just on the player, but the type of card. Now, another thing that it depends on is rarity, but not only rarity. And I fell victim to this when I first got back into the hobby. I'll give you an example. So 2006, I remember getting a box of 2006 Upper Deck Future Stars. It was a birthday gift from my parents because I think they heard that I was possibly getting back into the hobby, if I remember correctly. I don't recall exactly what all the circumstances were surrounding this, but nevertheless, I have this beautiful box of shiny baseball cards, and it was the first box I'd opened in, you know, forever. So I open it up and I see this guy named Alex Rodriguez. Super excited about this because I think it's Rodriguez that was the baseball superstar, but I couldn't remember. I realized it was either Alex Rodriguez or Alex Gonzalez. Well, I found out, much to my delight, it was Alex Rodriguez. Now, the thing was this Alex Rodriguez was colored a little differently than the others in the pack. I turn around, or maybe it was on the front, I don't remember anymore. But I look, and it's serial numbered. And it's serial numbered to 99. And I almost lost it. I was so excited. Surely, a superstar baseball card that's limited to just 99, that's under 100 copies, has got to be worth a lot of money. And so as I found out very quickly, unfortunately, that's not the case, because there are a lot of cards that were serial numbered 100 or less back then. Now, this is completely contrary, of course, to how the baseball cards were when I grew up, which was like smack dab in the heart of the junk wax era, where they printed millions of every single baseball card. But nevertheless, I had this card of a superstar that was limited, even though there are other versions of that exact same card out of, you know, probably 75 and 50, 25, and so on and so forth. But like I said, I found out it wasn't really worth a whole lot. So we have two sides that are pulling here. We have one side that says, hey, look, if there's a popular player on the card, surely it's valuable. And then the other side we have, well, if it's serial numbered, and perceived to be rare, then it's valuable. And unfortunately, it's not the case necessarily in either situation. So a lot of times, in order to make a card valuable, there has to be multiple points that intersect. And when I say multiple points, I mean, any of these. For instance, the player choice, the set itself, the significance of the player on that specific set, the actual rarity of the card, and perhaps the history of the card itself. I try to, if I remember, I don't have any notes here at all. I'm literally just kind of pulling this out of my brain as I'm walking, but I'll try to remember going through each one of these here. So let's say, for example, if we have a proof or a prototype or whatever you want to call it of a blank back card that you don't see any others out there of. Like, let's say it's a 1991 Fleer blank back of Kent Herbeck. Look, it very well might be the only one around, or at least the only one that ever surfaces. You might be able to put a $10 price tag on it on eBay, and it might never sell. Why? Because it's quite possible that no Twins or Kent Herbeck collectors out there find it valuable enough or interesting enough for their collection to pay the $10. So you lower it to $5, might get somebody, but maybe not. You might lower it all the way down to $3, $2, $1, and say, forget it. This is going in my dime box, and next time I set up at a card show, it's just going to be something that some excited Twins fan sees a card that they've never seen before. Now, if you have, for instance, let's say a Bobby Bonilla, a 1991 Fleer blank back Bobby Bonilla, you put it up for $10. You put it up for $20. I don't know. Just depends. You might have a Bobby Bonilla super collector really pumped about this blank back stuff, like super excited, and so they might pull the trigger at $10 or $20, especially if there are two Bobby Bonilla super collectors that go after the same thing. Because guys, all it takes for a certain type of card to skyrocket are two cards. Two super collectors that have deep wallets. And is that the term? I think it's deep pockets, actually. So, rewind that, erase it. Not deep wallets, deep pockets. So, you think about it this way. You have two guys that have a lot of money going after the same thing. It's going to be a massive difference compared to just one guy that's got a lot of money to throw around. Because when there's competition, there's a lot of hobby dollars that can be spent. And I will give you two very good examples. There are two players. If you have been collecting for the last 5 or so years heavily, and you've had your ear to the ground, you will have heard what had happened in the past with two players by the name of Omar Vizquel and Andrés Galarraga. Omar Vizquel and Andrés Galarraga, two very good baseball players. Would they be considered superstars? Not by my account. I wouldn't say so. In fact, I was never really too terribly excited about either player. I mean, they were just another player to me growing up. Andrés Galarraga had a memorable nickname, the Big Cat. He also had a near impossible last name to spell. I think Donruss on his Rated Rookie, if I remember correctly, got the name wrong. Omar Vizquel, I think that he ended up, I don't even know. I know he was a really good player, but thing is I just don't know anything about him because he just wasn't on my radar. I think he played for the Mariners and the Indians. And when he was with the Indians, if I remember correctly, I think he was on the Indians during that stellar, magical time for Indians fans. During the mid-90s, I think they had May Ramirez and Albert, don't call me Joey Bell, and all that, and got all kinds of other rabbit trails that I can go down, even talking about the Indians back then and all their, you know, gold chains that they'd wear and everything. But anyways, that's my guess anyways. I think that he was part of those teams back then. But anyways, nevertheless, these players were not like superstars. They weren't like a Ken Griffey Jr. or Frank Thomas. They didn't rise above the teams that they played for make headlines. You weren't going to hear about them for decades after. But guess what? Things changed dramatically when both of these players had not one, but two deep-pocketed collectors of these guys. And what happened was absolute just hysterics. It was crazy. The way that this was manifested was watching these auctions, the prices skyrocket, and eventually people started taking notice when the Vizquels and Galarragas started getting to these like astronomical prices, and they were beating in many times Ken Griffey Jr. and Frank Thomas, Cal Ripken Jr., Derek Jeter, it was crazy to watch. And it was literally, from what I recall, just two different buyers that won the same card. And so the value on those cards, what happened eventually, is a couple of things, which was really fascinating to watch. Not only did you have certain very low number cards go up in value, but you also had all kinds of other cards of theirs go up in value too, because everybody else saw how much these others were going for. And so all these other dealers and resellers and flippers, or whatever you want to call them, started picking up various cards of them as well. And it raised the value of all of them. Something else that was interesting was the card companies started taking notice. And when they took notice, what happened ultimately was they started not only featuring these players that otherwise would have never been featured with of the all-time greats of baseball, they also started making more cards of them and including them in more of the sets. So they knew their market. They knew that people were going to start being interested in getting these cards. And even these little anomalies, like a 91 Fleer blank back, Vizquel or Galarraga, seemingly could have been put for whatever price that the buyer whatever price that the seller wanted to put on them, and they would have sold. And I remember, if I remember correctly, I believe that the a five star. Actually, you know what? I'm going to pause this right now because I'm actually going to look it up before I say anything. So, hang tight, one sec. Okay, so I pulled up a list of some of these cards, these one of ones of Omar Vizquel, for instance. Let me give you a couple examples of what they sell for nowadays. Pull the slider down. Okay, so we have a 2019 Archives Signature Series Omar Vizquel on Card Auto, one of one, that sold for $26. We have a buyback one of six that sold for $25. Another one of one for $26. We have a 2002 Heritage Auto, one of one, that sold for $60. Another Archives for $37. So these prices are what you'd probably expect. There's another $31 card, $45. Let's see what else here. $45. So basically from $20 to $50, for the most part, is what these one of one Omar Vizquel cards sell for these days. Now, what I'm going to do, is we're going to rewind the clock a little bit here to 2015-2016. And a lot of these cards, I'll give you some prices here for some one-of-ones. $2,975, $2,500, $2,000, $2,000, $3,800, $2,000, $1,750, $2,800, $2,000, $2,850, $3,500, $2,500, $2,500, $1,500, $3,000, $3,000, $3,500, $2,000, $3,000, and so on and so forth. And it got so crazy that one card, let me see if I can find it, to give you an example, which caused everybody to notice. August 7th, 2015, a 2015 Topps Tier 1 Omar Vizquel acclaimed Gold Ink 1 of 1 sold for $10,200. $10,200 for an Omar Vizquel 1 of 1 card that may very well have gone for $40 or $50 if that, if it was on the market today, and had that not happened, because I'd imagine there's some notoriety to that card and that when you start thinking about it because of what happened. But if there were only one big time super collector back then, that may have been a wildly different situation where where it would have only gone for like $40 or $50 as opposed to over $10,000, which is absolute insanity. And I remember this one time, which is kind of fun to see. I remember writing an article around that same time, had nothing to do with Vizquel or Galarraga. It was on my radar, but not enough to write about. But I wrote an article about the 1991 Topps glow back variations. And to give you an example of what those are, if you turn your 1991 Topps baseball cards around and put a black light on them, some of them will glow and some won't. There's not really a massively noticeable difference in rarity from one or the other, but I did write about it, and all the player collectors, once they heard about it, wanted to get one for their collection, different variations of their collection, myself included. I mean, shoot, I was right there in the mix. I wasn't willing to pay all kinds of money, especially since I knew that I could probably pick them up for, you know, pennies or something if I just wanted to buy a box or complete set or whatever and just try my luck on it. But anyways, nevertheless, it was a fun article, and people got super excited. It exploded. The next day, eBay started getting all kinds of listings of glowback variations after my article. Now, before I wrote the article, there was absolutely none out there. Nobody had any on eBay. Next day, everybody did. In fact, over the next couple weeks or something, I think there were hundreds or thousands of these auctions that were listed on eBay. And interestingly enough, if I remember correctly, the Omar Vizquel sold for maybe a few hundred or something. Matter of fact, I'm gonna pull that up in my system now and see if I can look it up. I'm going to look up Vizquel Glow. We'll see what comes up here. Slider down. Okay. So it looks like a couple of them sold for, the first one here sold for $500. And there's a couple others. One sold for $300. Another sold for $180. So there are a few that brought in some good money. But ultimately, the first one that hit the market sold for $500. And thing was, is it wasn't really all that rare. It's just the collectors that said, I need this card for my collection. I don't know how rare it is. And they just went for it. And they wanted to be the first ones to get it instead of their competition. So if y'all didn't realize this, by the way, I can tell you firsthand, when it comes to super collecting, competition is absolutely 100% real. It's a real thing. And yeah, I find that interesting. I always remembered that one Glowback that wasn't really rare going for all that money. You know, you can also kind of add that into the pile. You know, when you have a player, you know, as far as what makes a card valuable, if you have the right player on the right type of card, and you also have multiple people that are big spenders going for that same type of card, then you got fireworks going. And I've seen that a lot in the Canseco market as well. So you have a card out of 10, for example, you can have the first few that sell for decent money. But after the first, you know, 2, 3, 4 people that pay good money for that out of 10 card, have it in their collection, if you have one that goes at auction, it might go for, you know, less than half or even less than a third of what the others have sold for. You know, so it's because the cards that are numbered out of 10, it's more than enough to satisfy the big spenders for not just Canseco, but a lot of other players as well. And I'm really kind of talking mainly about the newer listings because, or the newer releases, because if you have a card that's numbered out of 10 from say 2000, 2001, 2003, 2004, you know, it's going to be a much bigger difference because not all of the big guys are going to have those cards and they're not going to show up. Like in a new release, if cards number out of 10, you might have all 10 show up within the first month or two. You know, so it's kind of funny how that works. So not all serial number cards are the same. So all that to say, there's definitely a lot of intersection that needs to happen for a certain card to bring a lot of money. I will give you probably my most intriguing, I guess, example that's always kind of perplexed me. And this has to do with the T206 Wagner. So just to kind of give everybody a rundown of what's going on with the T206 Wagner again, is it's always been known, as far as I can tell, as the card to have. So if anybody who's anybody in the hobby has one dream card that's like completely out of reach, out of touch, and they could have just one card, they hit the lottery and they could have just one card, the T206 Honest Wagner would be it. Now, this is for a few reasons. First of all, the funny thing is about Honest Wagner is a lot of people that would just kill to have that card don't even know who Wagner is. But Wagner was actually a ridiculously good baseball player. In fact, many people considered him at the time to be the best player in baseball on the planet. He was that good. He was a likable guy. People really enjoyed him. He was humble. He was basically like the opposite of Ty Cobb, but had so much of a nice demeanor. And he also just was, you know, ridiculously fantastic of a player. Excuse me. As a matter of fact, in I think it was the 1909 World Series, if I remember correctly, the Pirates and the Tigers were going against each other. So, and just as a reminder, there's a lot of people that would think that would call Ty Cobb as the best player in all baseball. And so, so this is when the best of the best met up with the best of the best in the 1909 World Series. Pirates versus the Tigers, headlining Honest Wagner and Ty Cobb. And as the story goes, Ty Cobb you know, first of all, they shook hands and were very cordial at the beginning. And Ty Cobb gets on base for the first time. And he yells down to second base, you better look out, I'm coming for you, Krauthead. And, you know, Wagner is German. And so he ends up trying to steal second, if I remember correctly. And as he slides in, you know, Ty Cobb was notorious for sliding in with spikes up and trying to hurt people. Wagner gives him a bloody lip as he's tagging him out. And, you know, I'm not sure if that story is true or not, but that's how the legend goes. And ultimately, honest Wagner got the best of Cobb by a long shot. Pirates won. You know, Wagner was just like, he ran circles around Cobb as far as stats go. So, but interestingly enough, in spite of how wonderful honest Wagner was as a baseball player, his career is overshadowed by the greatness of this baseball card. Why? Well, there's a story. Like, how did it get to be the number one card? Well, as baseball cards became, you know, such a huge investment sensation, rarity was a big thing for people back in the 80s and 90s. Still is, but, you know, it's obviously a different thing nowadays. Back in the 80s and 90s, they saw honest Wagner as a super rare card, and it is. There's probably 50 cards, 50 copies of it or so that are out there that still exist. But back then, people would even mistakenly say, it's the rarest card out there. Oh, no, that's not true. People would say, well, it has to be the rarest card because it's the most valuable. But that just doesn't... That doesn't do it. That doesn't satisfy why. Doesn't give us the entire reason why. So, honest Wagner, as it was said, he did not agree with the tobacco companies putting his likeness on their product and thus causing problems or you know, being a bad influence, so to speak, on the kids that were his fans. He didn't want them saying, hey, Wagner partakes in tobacco, so we should too. So they pull it from the run. Only 50 or so survive, and this wonderful story emerges of how it's so rare, and it's got a fantastic story behind it. Of course, it was like four decades later, honest Wagner is featured on a 1948 Leaf baseball card chewing tobacco or something like that, which, by the way, some people say that contradicts and debunks the whole story, but it doesn't in the least to me. It's it could be just a case of do as I say, not as I do, or he could have gotten hooked on tobacco later on in his career. Just don't know. But so you have like this perfect storm. You have like a fantastic baseball player who, by the way, nowadays people don't remember all the wonderful stories of how awesome of a player he was. But you have that. You have this wonderful story of this almost superhero type player that said, no, pull my card from the print. And so it almost gave this it's a bit of a mystique of the card where, like, if somebody has it, it's they have something now that they shouldn't, which has always been kind of exciting for any collector to have, which is why I really enjoy my 1988 Topps Cloth Test or 89 Donerson Leaf Blue Chip cards that weren't supposed to get out, you know, and that are, frankly, quite possibly way rarer than the honest Wagner. But anyways, top that off, you know, to add to it, it's part of the famed T206 set, which has like, I think 520 baseball cards in the set, which, is a pretty big deal. It's got all of the players. It's got, Ty Cobb, Cy Young, Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson, it's a everybody like Chief Bender, Home Run Baker, Huey Jennings, John McGraw. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on of who's on there. Rube Waddell and all of these players, a lot of them anyways, Tris Speaker, Napoleon Lajoie, a lot of these players have multiple types of cards in the set, and they're just all so beautiful. Like, you look at, for instance, the card of the Hall of Famer Wee Willie Keeler. You look at the background and the artwork of it. I mean, it's just top notch. And the same goes for all kinds of other players there in the set. I mean, it's just chock full of Hall of Famers. And interestingly enough, this is kind of one of my famous rabbit trails here, I guess. But throughout the entire set, there is simply one person, one player that is featured with a mustache. And that player is John Titus. Nobody else has a mustache in the set, which is interesting because if you turn back the clock a few decades to the time when Alan Ginter, Old Judge, Gypsy Queen, Goodwin, all of them were creating cards, you would rarely see anybody without a mustache. So something happened in fashion back then that said, hey, no more mustaches. And of course, as we know, mustaches came roaring back, but it didn't happen until the mid-70s with, I think, the Oakland Athletics. And thanks to Reggie Jackson and Raleigh Fingers and all them. So, but anyways, thing I found interesting about this T206 story, which means that there really has to be a perfect storm here, is you look at, you compare that T206 Wagner with the E90-2 Lance Wagner. They look very similar as far as cards go. The portrait from Carl Horner, I think it was used in both cards. It was painted or whatever, and they used the same type of portrait, just different artwork. The E90-2 was distributed with candy, I think caramel actually, some sort of caramel candy, and it's got a beautiful blue background, and it's the same, around the same time period, 1910 is when it was issued. And so my first thought would be, well, why haven't I heard of this card? Like, I didn't know this card existed until earlier this year. And I remember seeing it going, man, this is quite possibly a card here. I've never seen it before, and it is beautiful. And it looks so strikingly similar to the T206 card in many ways. And so I looked at it. It's not a cheap card by any stretch of the imagination. But in my opinion, it is way cheaper than it should be. So I started thinking, why is this? Well, first of all, the set itself. I mean, because it's like it's the same player, Hans Wagner, looks very similar. In fact, the E90-2, in my opinion, looks quite a bit better than the T206 card. So, you know, what's the deal? Why is this card not worth hundreds of thousands of dollars also? Well, a couple reasons I came up with. Because, interestingly enough also, turns out the rarity is similar. So you have the T206 and the E90-2. Both of those cards, according to the pop reports and PSA and SGC and all that, they're very similar. I think nowadays the T206 has a few less than the E90-2s. But it's incredible to me that there's such a disparity in value of the two. Which I think that's going to change. I really do. I think that the E90-2 has a lot of room to grow. But so first of all, why the disparity? Number one, I'd say probably the set. You don't have a whole lot of people that know what an E90-2 set is. And it's a candy type of card. Same dimensions basically as the tobacco cards, but when you think of baseball cards, pre-war baseball cards, the best of the best, you think of tobacco cards, not candy cards, which, gosh, candy cards are so cool, though. But the thing is they don't have the same notoriety that these tobacco cards have. And tobacco cards and baseball are just synonymous. So not a whole lot of people know about these candy cards. The set itself, T206, it is an iconic name. It is the name that stands out above everything else. You've heard of probably the T205 Gold Borders, the T207s, the T210s, the T201s, T202s, all those. But the T206 stands out. Beautiful artwork, nice clean white border. Bottom it says the player's name and the team and all that. So it all just works so beautifully together. So you have similar rarity, but the notoriety just isn't there. You also don't have the story of Honest Wagner saying, hey, I don't want my likeness associated with candy because I don't want the kids to associate my name with candy and therefore giving them all kinds of toothaches and cavities or whatever. It just didn't happen that way. But it was a much more limited run, allegedly, also, which probably accounts for number one, the fact that not many people heard of it. Number two, that it's such a smaller print run overall than the T206 counterparts. And the set all together, by the way, is really nice. I think they're, I could be getting my candy releases mixed up, but I do know that Shields Joe Jackson has his rookie in that, possibly that set, or maybe it's E90-1. I don't know, but I know Cy Young has a beautiful striking red background card for his time during while he's playing for Boston in an E90-1 card. There are a couple E90-1 can cards like Christy Mathewson. They're gorgeous. Ty Cobb also. I mean, just incredible stuff. So, you know, definitely something to keep in mind there. But anyways, after all that we're talking about, all this stuff, I think it's important to note just all of the different little things that could play into making a card valuable. Kind of as a bit of a recap, it's likely not just one thing that's going to make a card skyrocket. It's going to be multiple things, and probably the more the better. You have player popularity, you have set popularity, you have rarity, you have a story, and you also have the people that are interested in the cards. And that's mainly gonna cause like super rare cards to skyrocket possibly. So remember what we looked at with the Omar Vizquel. One of his cards went for $10,200. And nowadays, there are some that don't even come close to cracking $100. Mind-blowing to me still, but it just goes to show you what happens when the perfect storm hits. So if you have any thoughts on this or anything else to add, I feel like I could have a lot more to add if I just kind of sat down and wrote about all this stuff out first and talked about it. But yeah, look, the whole reason I'm doing podcasts is because it's something I can just pick up my phone and headphones and talk away. So, but because of that, I certainly welcome your feedback and your information, what your thoughts are. If I missed anything, feel free to tweet me at TanmanBBFan or email me, TanmanBaseballFan@gmail.com. Please feel free also to reach out for anything else if you have any questions. I am happy to answer anything you might ask me. And finally, last but not least, please don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast. Thank you, everybody. I hope you all have a wonderful night.